Conference recording started.
Good morning, everybody, welcome to the Accessible Technology webinar series. I am Judith Stark, the Accessible Technology Consultant with the Pacific ADA Center, and just a reminder that the Accessible Technology webinar series is sponsored together with the Great Lakes ADA Center and the Pacific ADA Center, both of whom are members of the ADA National Network. So a couple of things before we begin. A reminder that if you have any questions, please feel free to enter them into the chat area on the left side of your screen. We will be monitoring them and responding to questions sometimes during the course of the session. Our speaker will take a break for some questions along the way, and also we will have questions at the end of the session too. A reminder that the session is being recorded and will be archived on the www.ada-audio.org website, and you will receive an email with a link to that archive as soon as it is available. Again, if you are wanting to use the closed captioning, there is a little icon at the top of your screen on the left-hand side, CC symbol, click on that and that will open the session for you. After the session, the handout will be emailed to you along with an evaluation survey, and we'd be very pleased and delighted if you take a moment to fill out the survey. That really helps us in planning our next set of webinars for you. Today's session is talking about digital access and the role of the law, and we are very pleased to welcome Lainey Feingold, who is going to be talking to us about the role of the law. Since 1996, Lainey, who is a graduate of the Hastings Law School, has had her own law practice in Berkeley, California, so in my part of the world. Lainey is a disability rights lawyer who works primarily with the blind community on technology and information access issues. She's nationally recognized for negotiating landmark accessibility agreements and for pioneering the collaborative advocacy and dispute resolution method known as structured negotiations. And the wonderful thing is that using this method and without filing a single lawsuit, Lainey has helped negotiate more than 50 legally binding national settlement agreements on accessible information and technology. And that's with some of the largest institutions in the country, including American Express, Weight Watchers, Bank of America, and a variety of others, including Major League Baseball, which is a wonderful thing. Lainey is a regular presenter with the International Technology and People with Disabilities Conference. Most people would know that as CSUN. She's taught disability rights classes at Bay Area law schools and has written and spoken extensively on disability rights issues around the country. So, wonderful person to have with us. She certainly kept me up to date with a lot of things that are happening in the legal world. She's very active on Twitter and is currently writing a book about structured negotiation, so look out for that. All right, so without further ado, welcome Lainey. Lovely to have you with us, and please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Judith. Can everybody hear me? Judith, how do I sound?
You sound perfect. Carry on.
Okay, great. Well, thank you all for being here and wanting to know what the role of the law is in the quest to make the digital world accessible to everybody. I want to start by thanking the ADA Network for having me as part of the series. And I want to let everyone know, if you don't already, that this was planned long in advance, but today happens to be Global Accessibility Awareness Day. So for those of you who tweet or do Facebook, the hashtag for that is GAAD. And there have been events all over the world starting at, you know, midnight last night, where people are getting together and trying to educate the developers, the designers, the website owners, that people with disabilities use the web, use mobile, use learning management systems, and all of this digital content and digital services need to be accessible. So I'm glad to be presenting on Global Accessibility Awareness Day. The title of the session is Digital Access and the Role of the Law, and the illustration I use for this is a toolbox. And the reason I use a toolbox is because there's a lot of different ways people are using the law, And I hope at the end of this session, I hope at the end of this session that all of you will be able to use the law. I know most of you, maybe none of you, are lawyers, but we can all use the language of the law and talk about civil rights as we're working in our own institutions to try to improve usability and accessibility. So let's see if I can advance the slide. Yes. Okay, so when we talk about the law and what we're going to do in the next hour and 10 minutes, so there's plenty of time for questions, is talk about what is going on in the legal space. But behind everything that's going on in the legal space are basically the quest for three things: equality, inclusion, and fairness. And I like to start off with that because a lot of times when people think about the law, they're thinking hammer and, you know, oh no, here come the lawyers. And I know our profession, my profession, doesn't have the best reputation, but the truth is that we're using the law in the digital space because we believe that people with disabilities have equal rights to digital content, to use the web, to use services, to have apps on the mobile phone. We believe in inclusion, that people shouldn't be left out of the digital revolution just because they can't see or they can't hear or they can't use a mouse or they have cognitive disabilities that affect how they process information. And really at the core of all that is fairness. And as technology moves forward, we must, every way we can, whatever our role is, and all of you sitting here in your, you know, desks or wherever you're listening to this, you all have some role in making the digital world more accessible. Otherwise, you wouldn't be there. You wouldn't be there. You wouldn't be here. So my role is to share the information from the legal world to the broader community and also to do the work that I do through structured negotiations in bringing accessibility to various large companies. So I want to start with talking about the U.S. Department of Justice. Okay, I see the way these slides go. I can't jump in the thing. So usually I like to say the slow bureaucrat starts at the top of the slide. Like, what do we think of the U.S. Department of Justice? Are they slow bureaucrats or are they accessibility champions? So I'm going to take a second for you to think about what your answer to that question would be, and then we'll look at what is the Department of Justice doing in the United States to advance digital accessibility. And you can decide for yourself when, you know, we go through this set of slides whether you think they're bureaucrats or accessibility champions. I will have a couple places along the way to take questions, but if you have a burning question before I get to that space, just type it into the box and I'll either catch it or Judith will let me know that it's time to stop for a question. So the U.S. Department of Justice, slow bureaucrats are accessibility champions. My conclusion is accessibility champions. And the reason for that is that U.S. Department of Justice is the agency responsible for enforcing the Americans with Disabilities Act. And they work in primarily two parts of the ADA that are of importance here. One is Title II, which is the part of the ADA that covers state and local government. And one is Title III, which is the part of the ADA that covers private companies, which somewhat confusingly are called public accommodations. But public accommodations are private companies that interact, private entities that interact with the public, movie theaters and shops and schools that are private, things like that. So the Department of Justice has the ability to investigate claims of discrimination. They can file lawsuits. They can get involved in other people's lawsuits. They can negotiate settlement agreements, and they can issue regulations. So the first thing I want to talk about is what is the Department of Justice doing in what they call their enforcement arm, where they're investigating complaints, they're negotiating with entities to make sure content and services are accessible in the digital space. So first thing I'm going to do is let you know what kinds of entities they are working with, and then we'll look at what exactly they're doing with those entities. So the breadth and scope of the kinds of entities that the Justice Department is looking at to make sure content and services are accessible is very broad, which is one of the reasons that I consider the Justice Department Civil Rights Division to be accessibility champions. So the first one is I have on the list here is edX, which is, for those of you who can't see it, it's small ed, capital X, which I hope is right. I think it is. And this is an online learning platform originally put together by Harvard and MIT. Wait, am I still there? I'm getting... Judith, is everyone hearing me? I'm good. Okay, thank you. I guess the phone bridge must have disconnected, sorry. So Harvard and MIT has put together a learning platform.
Can you wait while we get the phone audio so our phone participants can follow along? Thank you.
Yes, yeah, sorry.
If our captioner could possibly just make a note that we are just getting the telephone bridge reconnected, and we will be back in session fairly shortly. So please bear with us. Lenny, thank you. We will let you know as soon as it is a good time for you to continue. Once again, for those of you who are on the call with us, please just note that we are getting the telephone bridge reconnected. So please bear with us. It will be on in a second, and our moderator will let us know when that is reconnected. So please don't go away. We will be with you shortly. It looks like the telephone bridge might be up again. Claudia, can you please confirm that that is all working okay?
Yes, audio is working properly.
Lovely. All right. Thank you so much, and we appreciate your patience with that. Lainey, please go ahead.
Okay. Okay, so we're talking about the types of institutions the Department of Justice is looking at to make sure that accessibility and usability is incorporated into the digital content and services. So the first one is edX, which is the biggest or one of the biggest online education platforms for higher ed, started by Harvard and MIT, but it's used by a lot of other institutions now. And the Department of Justice recently announced a settlement agreement making sure that that system is accessible. And again, once I go through the types of institutions they're working with, we'll go more in depth into what are they exactly saying, what does the Department of Justice say when they settle, and basically what the Department of Justice is saying has really turned into a list of best practices for accessibility. But before we get to that, the Justice Department isn't just looking at the higher education space. They announced a very strong settlement with Madison County, New York, and Nueces County, Texas, about 3 or 4 months apart. They have a project called Project Civic Action, where the Department of Justice, based on a complaint or other criteria, can go into any state or local government and take a look across the board at their accessibility services and offerings for people with disabilities, not just tech, but wheelchair access and other types of accessibility. So they're all around the country on this. If anybody's listening who's working for a state or local government entity, really important to distribute these settlements to your teams and your people, because Some of these are very small entities. You can't really tell where they're going, or are they going to large counties. National Museum of Crime and Punishment, they did a settlement with. Again, it seems that they are looking just to do one or two types of institutions to really clarify what we've known for 25 years, that the ADA is a really sweeping statute that was really intended to open the doors of public and private life to people with disabilities. And I think most of you on this call know that this year is the 25th anniversary of the ADA on July 26th. And the types of institutions that the Justice Department is looking at for the digital space is as sweeping as the law is. So we have the National Museum of Crime and Punishment, DeKalb, Illinois, plus six, the slide says. And the reason it says plus six is DeKalb, Illinois was one of six cities that the DOJ went into to look at the digital offerings around employment. So all six of those cases, the Cal Plus 6, all seven of those cases deal with employment applications, online employment applications, and those parts of city websites dealing with job opportunities. So I think we all know that one of the areas we still need to do a lot of work in is right of people with disabilities for full employment. And so this is just one small piece of that, making sure that the content job applications can be filled out by people with disabilities regardless of how they use the computer. And job information is available in accessible format. So that's one example, but as of my last time I presented this, I had to start two slides to cover the breadth of what the Department of Justice is doing in their enforcement actions. They worked with the Florida State Police about their website. Peapod Grocery Delivery got a lot of attention because that's a privately owned company. It's not state and local government. It's online only. And the Department of Justice did a settlement with them last fall requiring that their services be fully accessible online and mobile to people with disabilities. Lucky Stores I have in here because, like I said a minute ago, the Justice Department can enter any case in the country to tell the judge what its opinion is of the case pending in front of it. And Lucky Stores was a case not about web access. It was about point of sale devices that have flat screen keyboards, which means that blind people cannot independently enter their PIN. So there was a case against Lucky Stores for not having point of sale devices with keypads. And the Department of Justice entered the case. They filed the brief and they said something very important about web access, which is why it's on the slide. And it's important enough I want to read you the sentence that the Justice Department said. So in the Lucky Stores case, it was about point of sale devices, which are not addressed in the ADA or in the ADA implementing regulations. But the Justice Department told the judge that that didn't really matter. And they wrote, indeed, there are many instances where the department has found physical and communication barriers not specifically identified in its regulation or the ADA standards to be covered under Title III of the ADA. For example, this is one of my favorite sentences in any court filing. For example, the department has long considered websites to be covered by Title III, despite the fact that there are no specific technical requirements for websites currently in the regulations or ADA standards. So that was in 2013. They had long considered websites to be covered. So that's just an example of what the Justice Department is doing around the country to get institutions and courts to understand that the digital space is part of the ADA. The Florida County Court Records is another example. We have an abysmal problem in the United States with the legal profession not making sure that content is accessible for people with disabilities. There are lawyers with all sorts of disabilities. We have a Disability Rights Bar Association. There's the Association of Disabled Lawyers, and still We have situations where court records aren't available in accessible formats, to say nothing of witnesses in the public who have a right to see those records. So that's just an example of the type of institutions they're working with. They're filing complaints, they're settling agreements. And what do they do in those settlement agreements? The agreements don't just say, go make your website accessible and leave it at that. The DOJ is doing a really wonderful job at going into the specifics of what does it really mean to make content and services accessible, and what do you have to do institutionally to have long-lasting change? Because we all know that digital content changes quickly, services and technology change quickly. Unless we can embed accessibility and usability into the DNA of these institutions, we're going to be back to maybe not square one, but you know, square half or square two. So the DOJ settlements, I really encourage you to read them. I'll have the link in a couple minutes where you can read all these agreements. They're public. They're posted on the web in accessible format. So the first thing to know is in all these agreements, the Justice Department is looking at both web and mobile. Both web and mobile. And in the edX case, they have a third and fourth category of content management systems and learning management systems. So they're very broad in scope, which is good because, you know, now we have to worry about the accessibility of the Apple Watch. We have to talk about digital services and content and not any one specific kind of technology. So the Justice Department is doing that by, in their settlements, always talking about web and mobile. The standard they're using is the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, which we refer to as WCAG 2.0 level AA, which is an international standard. There are a lot of techniques for meeting it. It's just great that the Department of Justice is using that as a standard. Their agreements are applying not just to the web content that the site owner posts or puts up, but to third-party content, which is very important. From the end user's perspective, when we go to a website, we don't know if the site owner posted it, if they purchased the content or the feature or the functionality from a third party. So it's very important that the Justice Department is having all these institutions it's dealing with look at the third-party content. When we do settlement agreements, like Judith mentioned, I have an agreement with Major League Baseball and Weight Watchers, Bank America, various other institutions, and we always are talking to the companies about, you know, look at your request for proposal. Are you demanding that when you purchase technology and features and content that it's going to be accessible for everyone? So that's really important that the Justice Department is doing that. Their agreements require the institutions to hire an independent consultant. And the Justice Department is going to be looking at who those consultants are. They have to be approved by the Justice Department. There haven't been any approvals yet, and there's no public list. But the agreements do say that the Justice Department will approve the independent consultant. There's staff training requirements up and down, not just the web developers. Anyone who's going to be touching content or making decisions about features and functions. There's requirement for web accessibility coordinator, which is a really important thing. Some of the private agreements do that also, just to make sure that the idea of accessibility is, again, embedded in the DNA of the institution across the board. And again, Justice Department is getting very specific about what's required. It doesn't all fit on one slide. So other requirements in these agreements, and again, every agreement does not have each of these elements because every agreement is unique to the specific facts of whoever the settlement is with. But taken all together, these are pulled from each one of these elements is in at least one, and usually more than one of the Justice Department agreements, and really constitute a best practice. So they're using a testing tool, an automated testing tool. They're also requiring usability testing, which is very good because we know that while an automated testing tool is good, it's important, it can give you a snapshot, it can really only catch, I think they say like 20% of the accessibility issues. And even things that are caught or even things that are looked at that they are fine, there can still be usability issues. So they have very good language on usability, which I just want to give you a flavor for. Yeah, so this is out of the Madison County agreement, but the language is similar in many of the other Justice Department settlement agreements. So they say that the Madison County is supposed to assess all existing web content and online services for conformance with WCAG 2.0 AA by doing the automated testing and also by enlisting individuals with different disabilities, including at a minimum individuals who are blind, deaf, and have physical disabilities such as those limiting the ability to use a mouse to test its pages for ease of use and accessibility barriers. So that is very important to get in there. There is no substitute, in my experience working with institutions for 20 years on these issues, for the developers, the Q&A people, to actually meet their users with disabilities and see what the experience is. So it's great that the DOJ is recognizing that. For those of you who are on Twitter and following the hashtag GAAD for Global Accessibility Awareness Day, there are a lot of tweets encouraging people to give up their mouse for 1 hour today to see what it's like. And in my experience, when people actually do that, and if those of you on this session haven't done it yet, it's your homework assignment after we're finished. Even 15 minutes, start with your own site, go to your favorite site and see if you can maneuver it without using your mouse, because many, many people access content and don't have the ability to use a mouse. Another great thing the Department of Justice is doing in these agreements is they're requiring the institution to add the question of accessibility to performance evaluations. So if you're a web developer and you're just like always screwing up the accessibility requirements, you're never adding alt text or you're never doing headings or any number of things, it's going to be something that will show up in your performance evaluation. So just another way to get these issues into the DNA of the institutions. The agreements require posting a policy, having a homepage accessibility information page, which I call AIP, very important to have front and center a place where people can go on your site, they can find out what you're doing about accessibility, phone number where it's going to be answered by someone who knows, email address that will be answered. You know, I know there is some feeling amongst big companies like, oh, we shouldn't put up a page unless we're perfect because it's just going to highlight that we're not perfect. I totally disagree. I think people appreciate and need to know, you know, okay, this company has a policy, they're working towards it, and here's who I can call if there's a problem. So the Justice Department is recognizing that by requiring these homepage. When I say homepage, it has to be a link on the homepage to an accessibility information page. And the agreements all have time frames. They could range anywhere from 6 months to 18 months. I think one of them might go to 2 years. Giving the entity a chance to really do it right and get it done. So that's the ADA DOJ enforcement activities. The DOJ and federal agencies are doing other things, and private parties are doing other things. But this is a good stopping place. So if anybody has a question, I can answer it. You can type it in or ask it however.
Thanks, Annie.
however
A couple of things. Somebody did ask which case you were doing that you were quoting. That was a little while ago, but I think that you were going to provide a link to where those cases are. Do you have that URL that we can put into the chat room, or we can tell people what that URL is? And then the second question is, you mentioned testing tools, and I know that this is a favorite topic that always comes up. I know my answer to it, but I'd be interested to know your answer to it. Do they recommend any particular testing tools? Because there are, you know, a number of them out there. Just, you know, to be more, possibly if you can suggest a few, or if you don't suggest a few, that's also an important thing to know too. But what do you do with a testing tool?
Okay, in terms of the links, the two things I actually read to you from the Lucky Stores case is the one where the Justice Department said that they have long considered the web covered. It's called the Lucky Stores Statement of Interest. The usability testing language came from the Madison County Agreement. I have on my website a category. My website is lflegal.com and /categories, the IES. And there's a legal update category. So I do a legal update. I do this presentation at CSUN every year, and a couple years ago I started doing a legal update for my website because everyone wants the slides posted, but the slides don't really tell you that much. So I do have content on my website that has links to every single one of these cases with a brief explanation. The most recent legal update I believe I did in March of this year, and I intend to do another one by the end of June. So you can, again, it's lflegal.com/categories, and you will see the category of legal update. I also, my email address is lf@lflegal.com, and 4 or 5 times a year I do a send out. And if you want to be on my list for send out, you can send me an email. And I also, every time I hear something, I put it on Twitter. And I'm on Twitter at LFLegal. So, and you can always email me. I'll put it at the end. If you have a question about something after the session, you can't find the authority or the link, I'm always happy to respond to email or call me on the phone.
Thanks, lady. Okay. Just one other quick question that did come up was,
the testing tool, and then somebody's also
asking if DOJ requirements for, if there are any DOJ requirements for updating currently existing sites. In other words, do you have to go back, how far do you have to go back, and what are their requirements for retrofitting, using a good California earthquake word, for retrofitting sites? What were the requirements for that?
Okay, so first on the testing tools, the agreements say that the Justice Department will approve testing tools, but they have not done so yet. So there is no list of Department of Justice testing tools. It's not something that I maintain either. I really recommend that people who are in the digital accessibility space be on Twitter, because if you put a tweet up that said, if you put up a tweet that said, what are the 3 top testing tools, you would get really good answers. Twitter has a hashtag, which is A11Y, which I discovered is sort of tech shortcut. When you have a long word, you put the first letter, the last letter, and the number of letters total. So that's why accessibility is A11Y. And even if you're not on Twitter, you can go to twitter.com and you can search that hashtag and you can find out a lot of good information. So I tend to be vendor neutral and I don't have recommended testing tools. In terms of updating the sites, these, again, we don't, and we'll talk about this in a second, we don't have regulations yet from Department of Justice dealing with that specific question. In these agreements, they are talking about the site. They're not distinguishing, in most cases, going forward or going back. And that's why there's a time frame. So I would say the most important thing for if you don't have an accessibility plan yet is to find your standard, which really should be the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines 2.0 AA, and have a plan to work towards that. But the Justice Department hasn't made any big pronouncements on, you know, you only have to go back this far, or you don't have to look at this sort of old material. Because if you have it on, I mean, the basic idea of it, back to the original slide about fairness and equality, if you have it on your site, there must be a reason for it. And some people say, oh, this is so old, no one will ever look at it. Well, then what do you have it there for? So you have to think about, why do you have it? What kind of people are going to want to access it? What can you do to make sure that it's available to everyone? Okay, so I'm going to move on because there's so much going on in the legal space. In addition to enforcement action, there's the question of regulations. So let's start with Section 508. 508 covers federal procurement. Many states have adopted their own version of 508. So a lot of times people who work in state government think, well, 508 applies to us. Actually, 508 only applies to federal government, but many states have their own, what they call little 508. So as a shortcut, people say, yeah, 508 applies to the state. The actual language for 508 is it applies to information technology developed, procured, maintained, and used by federal agencies. So the 508 regulations, if you're on this call, you may know or you may not know that there has been a multi-year effort to update them. The current 508 regulations are close, I think, to 15 years old, which is really kind of amazing. So we are right now in the period of the update, and I'm not going to spend too much time on the regulations, but just really big picture. The 508 regulations are done not by the Department of Justice, but by the Access Board, and they have highlighted four main factors of the current. Like I said, the current version is from 2000, but we're right in the middle of hopefully updating it to a more modern version. And the four, we'll talk about the timing in a second, the four highlights of the new changes are a very broad application of WCAG, the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. The proposed regulations apply it to web, software, and offline electronic documents. So that's an important change from the old 508. The new 508 has a lot of details about covered electronic content, everything that's public facing, and then they have a list of eight non-public facing content that still is covered by the 508, like emergency notifications or benefits, you know, various issues that would affect federal employees. The new regulations expand interoperability requirements, which has to do with how the web and software interacts with assistive technology. And there's a new requirement for real-time text functionality, which allows for real-time communication. I'm not an expert in that aspect of the technology, but apparently it goes letter by letter instead of word by word, so it allows for real time. And if I got that wrong, someone put in a question and I'll clarify it. So what you really need to know about 508 right now is the timing. We have the old regulations. On February 27th, 2015, the Access Board issued what they call NPRM, which is the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. And that was after years of committee study and reports. And finally, February 27th, 2015, the like all federal regulations, when they issue a notice, they have to have a comment period. The comment period closes next week on Thursday, May 28, 2015. So if anybody wants to comment, you still can. And the Access Board has, I think it's accessboard.gov, but you can just put it into Google, and if you put Access Board 508, you get right to their page where you can read all about the changes and the proposals. So sometime after the comment period closes, they will issue a final rule. And the slide says question mark, because there's no deadline on when they have to publish the final rule. There's a big feeling in the accessibility community that it's very important to get these regulations out, that they may not be perfect, but we have waited a long time for new ones, and so the Access Board should get them out as soon as possible. I haven't heard too much about serious objections to these rules, except there is a push by people with low vision to improve their requirements for accessibility for people who can read text and need enlarged, not just enlarged text, but something called user-controlled text, which allows the end user to modify everything from spacing between letters and color contrast, spacing between words and lines. So there is a feeling that the 508 doesn't go far enough in that area. We'll see whether the Access Board wants to make any changes or not. Once they issue the final rule, 6 months later, it will be in effect. So that's something to watch out for the rest of this year. So that's the 508 regs. Again, it only applies to federal government procurement and federal government websites. So the real question on a lot of our minds that work in this space is, well, what about the ADA web regulations? And I have my slide illustrated by a big blue question mark with a very sad-looking claymation guy or gal. I don't know if sad because it's just a head with no features. But like, when are these regulations going to come out? In 2010, the Justice Department said they wanted to regulate websites. They wanted to issue regulations, and they put out what they called an advanced notice of proposed rulemaking. ANPRM. And in that, they asked 19 questions, and many of us spent a lot of time answering those questions. Things like, what should be the standard for accessible websites? They have two sets of rulemaking going on. They have the Title II web regulation rulemaking, and that, again, the state and local government, there's one ANPM for that. And then they have the Title III regulations, rulemaking, private sector, public accommodations. Well, that was 2010. And every 6 months, the federal government that's involved in a rulemaking procedure is supposed to tell the public when they think the next step will be taken. So the next step for the web regulations will be the notice of proposed rulemaking, which they call the NPRM. Every 6 months for like the last 3 years, they've announced the deadline, and then when the deadline approached, they pushed the deadline back. So I know what the current deadlines are, but I don't even like to say them out loud because I just don't have a lot of confidence that we will see these regulations. But they do have a Title III date of June 2015 for the notice of proposed rulemaking. Unfortunately, for Title II, the date was the most current date is December 2014. I used to say in these, you know, when I did presentations like that, well, we don't need web regulations because the Justice Department has said repeatedly the ADA Title II and Title III covers websites. WCAG 2.0 AA is a standard. We don't need regulations. And part of that is still true. The ADA right now already covers websites and an accessible website means compliance with WCAG 2.0 AA and usability for people with disabilities. However, it would be nice to have the regulations for nothing else, you know, for no other reason than awareness. Someone put on Twitter this morning, well, maybe for Global Accessibility Awareness Day 2016, the Justice Department will issue the regulation. So I don't know. They're not there. Once they come out, the next thing is only the notice of proposed rulemaking. There'll be another comment period, just like with 508. There'll be, I think they have to have 3 months. I think that's pretty standard. And then they'll issue the proposed rule. So it's not on the horizon, but it's something, you know, actually it's not on the horizon yet. It could happen tomorrow. That's really all I can say about the web regulations. So let's take a few more questions before we start talking about what private advocates are doing outside the Justice Department.
Okay, thank you. There are a couple of questions that have come up. The first one is somebody has already been on your website to go and have a look at some of your agreements that you've seen and is asking if there are any agreements that impact publicly funded universities. Now, I'm not sure which state this particular person is asking for, but publicly funded universities. So that's number one. And then secondly is which states have their 508 regulations, if you know that, or how people can find out which states or if their particular state does have the equivalent of that 508 regulation.
Good question. I personally haven't done any work with higher ed, but once we get to what the private advocates are doing, I have some updates on cases and negotiations about publicly funded higher education. So we'll talk about that in a second. But you won't find it on my website. However, you will find it in the legal updates, because the legal updates on my website are not just about the work that I do, but they're about all the work I'm aware of in this space. And before I do these sessions, the National Federation of the Blind does a lot of work in this area, and I always check in with the other lawyers doing this work. So the legal updates, you will find links over the past year and a half. There's always an education category. I mean, there's always an education section in the legal update. So there's that. Did that book question? I think so. Are there any other questions?
I think that's
what time? Oh, no. Where to find the 508? I'm not aware of a list. I know California has one. But I think if you just Google the name of your state and sections, put in like section 508, name of your state, disability, you would probably find it. And you can email me afterwards if you have a particular question about a particular state. I'll be happy to find out the answer for you.
Great, thanks. And I presume that your answer about the publicly funded universities, would that apply to post-secondary colleges? Somebody is asking about how post-secondary colleges are coming under fire for non-accessible websites.
Yeah, okay, well let's jump to what's happening outside the Department of Justice. And before we do that, just real quick, the ADA website, the Department of Justice website is ada.gov, and they have a logo now, which I put on the slide, for ADA 25, 1990 to 2015. On ada.gov, you can sign up for their email list, and in your email box, you will soon know, as much as I know, about what the Justice Department is doing, because they put out a notice. Also, they post, most of these cases they do a press release, which is a little easier to understand than slogging through the whole settlement agreement. And at the bottom of the press releases, they always have a link to the full settlement. So right on their homepage, they keep a running tab of everything that they're doing. The most recent thing is the first thing that appears. So I really encourage those of you who want to follow Justice Department to get on that website and get their emails. Okay, so what is going on in the private space, legal advocacy? Again, I have the toolbox because lawyers and advocates around the country are using the ADA and Section 504, which we haven't really talked about. Section 504 applies to federally funded. Anything that receives federal funds have to be accessible. And so, especially in higher ed, you could have an entity that's covered by 504 because they receive federal funds. They could also be a state and local government entity because they're owned or run by the state. Some higher ed is totally private. So the advocates are using the law in a lot of different ways. Like Judith said at the beginning, I do structured negotiations, which is a collaborative dispute resolution method we use without litigation, without going to court. There's been very successful court cases. There's been complaints. So I have the remainder of the slides organized by the subject area because I think I do that to remind myself that these are all civil rights that we're talking about and the right to participate, the right to inclusion. So the first one I have is, I call it the right to watch, because there's a lot of activity going on closed captioning for streaming. And the National Association of the Deaf has really been doing a tremendous job on that. And they have settlements with Vudu, which is V-U-D-U, which is a streaming service of Walmart that I had never heard of, but apparently is very big, and there's an agreement that that's going to be 100% captioned. You know, the blind community was the original driver for a lot of the advocacy around accessibility online, and captioning for deaf people has really grown in prominence as an advocacy issue, in part because video is so much, you know, the web used to be mostly text, and now, I don't have a percentage here, but some gigantic percentage of internet use is video. So the National Association of the Deaf has an agreement with Walmart about Vudu. They did a lawsuit against Netflix, which was a very important case because there was this question, well, does the ADA apply to the web when there's no brick-and-mortar store connected? So Netflix is purely streaming, and the court said, yes, the ADA applies to Netflix. And after that decision, the case settled, and now Netflix has 100% captioning on their streaming video, and they're also starting to do audio description, which is great, which is a technology that allows blind people to get full movie content by putting in description during pauses in the dialogue, which I wish I had time to do a whole presentation on that, because if you've never seen or experienced audio description, I recommend you go to the, well, you could put it in and just, oh, now you can go to Netflix and you can just go to audio described and they'll list all the movies that are described. There's also a great website called YouDescribed, Y-O-U-Describe, which is a platform to allow people to describe YouTube videos. If you're in the mood to check it out and you're sighted, you can describe it. And if you need the description, you can then see what, it's like a crowdsourced description. So they have the settlement with Netflix. They did a settlement with Apple about videos in the Apple Store. And then the biggest sort of news on captioning in the legal space is a lawsuit that the National Association of the Deaf filed against Harvard and MIT for not captioning all their video content. Now, this is related to the edX Department of Justice case, but it's not the same. The edX Department of Justice case has to do with the platform and whatever content edX provides, but edX also allows each school to put their own content onto edX, and schools also have content that's not part of edX. So there is a pending lawsuit which will be closely watched. There's no court rulings out of it yet. Excuse me. Okay, so that's what's going on with captioning. The next area is what I call learning. And there's been a lot of legal advocacy around learning, websites for colleges, universities, K through 12. The first one is MASS. There's a lawsuit pending in Seattle brought by a blind mom who was unable, she had three kids in the public school system, and the school has like online math for parents to help their kids do their homework. That wasn't accessible. I believe the case is still going on, but might be in settlement conversations. And very sad to report that there's a new lawsuit filed just within the last 6 months against a community college in Chicago because a blind student was told that he had to drop an algebra class because he was blind. So there's a lot of work being done technically in the accessibility space to make sure math and science is available to people with disabilities, and the law is trying to push that forward. There was a settlement with the student loan, all the major student loan companies to make sure all student loan content, I think the Department of Education and the National Federation of the Blind did that. Youngstown and Cincinnati were two cases announced by the Department of Education. Like the Department of Justice, the Department of Education can enter cases, they can respond to complaints, and they've done a very good job with colleges and universities. One of these schools is public and one is private. I apologize. I'm not remembering which is which now, but on the same day, they announced settlements with Youngstown and Cincinnati, I think it's Cincinnati University and Youngstown University. And when the Department of Ed, sometimes joined by the Department of Justice or private NFB lawsuits, when they go into a university, it's across the board. It's websites, mobile, learning systems, registration systems, course material, as well as technology, kiosks. You know, more and more things go to kiosks, and if the kiosk doesn't have audio output or a way for people to input information, those aren't accessible. Clickers in the classroom to answer questions or get the attention of the teacher. So there's a lot of cases. These are the most recent ones. This Miami University, I think, might be a private school. This is another National Federation of Blind ongoing case across the board looking at the digital content at that school. The Department of this Miami University could have been back with the DOJ slides because last week the Department of Justice filed a brief in support of the plaintiff's position in the Miami University case. They came in to tell the judge that it's very important that the content as well as the services and the platforms be accessible. So that's the education space. This is the next slide is a picture of the Scribd downloader, which might be called Scribd. It's S-C-R-I-B-D. It's like the Netflix of books and movies. And for a pretty nominal monthly fee, you can download all the books you want. And, you know, it's just so distressing to me that in 2014, there has to be a lawsuit because this whole system wasn't accessible to blind people. And Disability Rights Advocates and National Federation of the Blind are doing a case on that in Vermont. And in my most recent legal update, I have a link to the court's decision. So far, there's been one decision. When the case was filed, the Scribd people tried to get it thrown out of court because they are just an online service and they're not connected to a brick and mortar institution. And the judge in Vermont issued really, you can only call it a beautiful court decision. I mean, I don't usually use the word beautiful in connection with court decisions, but it's worth reading because it really talks about, you know, this is 2015. Everything is digital. This is the bookstore. You know, the ADA is very clear and has been for 25 years that if you walk into a bookstore, you know, you have to be able to come in and get the services of the bookstore. This is the bookstore of 2015. So the case was not thrown out of court, and it's something to watch to see what is going to happen next. The Scribd company appealed to the Second Circuit of federal courts, And so the next thing that will happen is we'll hear what the Second Circuit has to say about this case. That could be a year from now, but that's where that case is. Really, really important. Okay, the next slide is not so much about web, more about digital technology, which is called Stay Healthy. It's illustrated by pill bottles with no labels. And that is the current, or that used to be the current state for blind people. When prescription labels and prescription information are in print, it's as if a blind person is getting a blank bottle. So in structured negotiations, we've worked with a lot of the nation's largest pharmacy retailers to change that. So now Caremark, mail order, CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart have accessible prescription information. There's several different technologies that are available. And we're working with the rest of the nation's retailers on that issue and hope to have you can watch for some more announcements of any of you in the healthcare space. So important to have health information accessible. You know, when I started this work in 1995, we focused on financial institutions and the importance of financial information privacy. We did an agreement through structured negotiations last year with WellPoint, which is the owner of, I think, 30 Blue Cross operations across the country. And they were a great negotiating partner. We didn't have to file a lawsuit. And they worked on the accessibility of their website, their emails, and their print documents. Today I got an email from a company that says, download our 10 tips for making the, I don't know if they said perfect or excellent website in the healthcare field, and accessibility wasn't one of the 10. So we really have to shift the mindset of the healthcare industry to understand the importance of accessible information. Sutter and Kaiser are two structured negotiations that my colleague Linda Dardarian is doing. And Sutter is a, and Kaiser are both, you know, local healthcare providers. And when you go to the websites and you want to look at your medical records, there's a link. If you're a screen reader, use this. And it's very integrated. And there's a lot of work being done in Massachusetts. Greater Boston Legal Services has done great work through structured negotiations with hospitals across the board, not just digital access, but physical access as well. So it's an area to pay careful attention to, and really important, especially, you know, telehealth and all this technology coming into the health field, electronic medical records. We have to just consistently be making sure that this information is accessible. Okay, voting. There's a case pending in Maryland that I think the Justice Department got involved with this one too. This was filed by the National Federation of the Blind. It's currently pending about online voting. This picture I have here is an accessible voting machine that blind people can use. The case has to do with online voting, and the judge said that they had an absentee voting system that was online. It had to be accessible. That's now being appealed, so that's something to watch for. That's out of Baltimore, Maryland. Do you have any questions, Judith?
No, nothing at this point. Just somebody had made a comment about Miami University is a public organization. Although I do have a question for myself, and that was going back to your pillbox technologies. Can you give us an idea of what some of those technologies are? The thing that comes to my mind would be a Braille label, but what other electronic or other technologies are you seeing with pillboxes? It's a very interesting area.
Yeah, that's a good question. There's basically, yes, Braille labeling is important, and some of our agreements do have Braille labeling, and that's an option. The push that we were going for were talking labels, and there's currently a couple different ways that a couple of different manufacturers, from the lowest tech, which is a small device that sticks onto the side of a prescription container. We try to use the word container, even though my pictures are pill bottles, because not all medication comes in a pill bottle, but all medication needs to be accessibly labeled. So in that device, the pharmacist records the information, and the user can get home, press a button, and just listen. The first thing they hear is their name. The second thing they hear is what the medication is, and then the dosage requirements. There's a product on the market called ScriptTalk by Envision America that has really been the pioneer in this field, where there's an RFID chip on the label, and the customer has a reader. It's like the size of a CD player. And as long as the container with the chip is close to the reader, it will read all the information about the prescription label. There's a digital audio label by a company called Accessimed, which sticks on the side of the container, and the user presses a button and can hear it all, but it's all digitally produced, so you don't have to worry about any issues of understanding the pharmacist, or it's not personally recorded by the pharmacist. It's technology from the pharmacist system into this digital audio label. So we're trying to get as many things on the market as we can. The Access Board did have a working group, and there is a best practice document. It's not only Braille and talking, but also large print, not just labels, but also patient information sheets, as well as the websites where you can get further information about the drugs and the interactions. The digital space on work, like I said before, this is the one area where the ADA has not really lived up to its promise. And as work becomes more digital, as back-end systems become technology, there really needs to be a focus on accessibility for the worker, not just for the public or the student or the member. So there's a couple cases pending on that. The American Council of the Blind has a lawsuit against GSA, the Government General Services Administration, for their website not being accessible, and that's pending in courts in D.C. There's a case against Marriott, which is closely watched, having to do with their reservation system, but for sure it's a system that workers use, and it's not accessible. There originally was a case out of California. That case has been resolved, and now there's a case in the East Coast against Marriott, which is pending. Montgomery County, Maryland, and Homeland Security also have pending cases brought by workers who were not able to do their jobs anymore because of new technology that was brought in that they couldn't use. The Montgomery County case is pending in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So these are going to be very important cases to watch. And as soon as we get some, there's really nothing to report on them. They're pending. The Montgomery County's on appeal. As soon as there's anything, I will put that out, because these employment cases are very important. Emergency preparation, that's another area where there's legal work going on. Emergency preparation for people with disabilities is a whole topic, and there's issues for wheelchair riders and physical, shelter issues. There's also digital issues when information is provided by phone, when information is provided on the web. So Disability Rights Advocates is a law organization both in Berkeley and New York, and they've done cases around the country. And they have a settlement with New York City, and I think Washington, D.C. might still be pending. You can find those on, you could just look up Disability Rights Advocates Emergency Preparedness, and you can see the scope. It's really important to remember the digital side of the whole emergency preparedness issue. There's still, like I said, I started working on accessible banking technology in 1995 when And that's how structured negotiations developed. My colleagues and I wrote letters to Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citibank and said, you know, your ATMs don't work for blind people, but rather than sue you, we'd like to talk to you about it. And kind of still to my amazement, they all said yes. And we had wonderful relationship with all three banks, and they've continued to be leaders in the digital accessibility space. Bank of America became the first bank in the country to commit to accessible online banking platform. We signed an agreement with them in 2000, and they've continued to be a leader in this field. But not everybody, is still a leader. So last year, the New York State Attorney General did a settlement with 12 New York banks, smaller banks, because their websites were not accessible. The New York State Attorney General and the Massachusetts Attorney General have been leaders in the Attorney General world in enforcing these. And that's another tool in the toolbox for advocates. You can go to your State Attorney General, and they have the power to investigate companies doing business or public, you know, government entities within the state. And New York did a very good settlement. Again, the link is in the legal update articles on my website. And Cardtronics is another talking ATM case that I think was worked on for 10 years. In fits and starts, they made their ATMs talk. They didn't. They weren't really working right. So they've made a renewed commitment. I put that on here because in so many of these cases, it's not like one and done. You do the settlement, and then everything's accessible forever. Maintenance is so important. Continued training. It's not just a one-time training. It's maintenance. It's training. It's really incorporating the accessibility principles so it just functions like any other aspect of the company or the school or the university. Okay. I want to make sure we have questions. So let me just... Let's talk really fast for a couple minutes, and then we'll have questions.
Yeah. Sorry, just you're doing fine. We're kind of up to date with the questions, so carry on. But I would encourage people, if you do have questions, please start to put them into the chat room right now so that we can address them before the end of the presentation. So sorry for the interruption. Lenny, go ahead.
Okay. So in the world of travel, you know, the right to travel is like a core, really a constitutional principle. And in disability access, the right to travel was core to the ADA, and wheelchair riders chain themselves in front of buses to get accessible transportation in that regard. And these are, you know, these are the modern day digital versions of making sure we have access to transportation. So there's three sort of pending cases. One is the case against Uber for not taking guide dogs. Not really digital, but I felt I had to throw it in here. Because Uber, you know, it's totally app-driven, app-based, and their app is, and Lyft and the other transportation ride-sharing services are pretty accessible, and there has been administrative work to make sure that happens. Now there's a case in California about Uber not taking guide dogs, and it's important both for people who use guide dogs, but also to see what the courts are going to say about whether Uber is even covered by the ADA because it claims it's not really a ride, you know, it's not really transportation. I don't know what they think they are, but so that's important to watch. There's a case pending in Southern California about in the back of a taxi cab when you slide your credit card, those machines can be accessible to people with disabilities, but too often they aren't. So there's a lawsuit about that. I have it illustrated with a taxi. It says credit cards accepted, but not really if your credit card machine is not accessible to people with disabilities. And then there's a case pending against the Department of Transportation. I didn't have a slide for this in the regulations. The Department of Transportation is in charge of airline access. Airlines are not covered by the ADA. They have their own disability discrimination law called the Air Carriers Access Act. And there are regulations there requiring websites to be accessible and meet WCAG 2.0 AA. And those go into effect, I mean, they're in effect, but the deadline is December, I believe it's December 12th of this year. So as of December 12th of this year, all airline websites, I think it's all, anyone operating, selling tickets in the United States, there might be some small exception to that, should be accessible. It's been a big hassle that airline websites are not accessible. People working on this have assured me that we're going to see a big difference on December 12th. So I don't know what's going to happen, but we can watch for that. At the same time, the Department of Transportation said websites have to be accessible. They also said airline kiosks have to be accessible, but they gave the airlines 10 years to make their kiosks accessible. And those of us in this room or in this conference call, that I think the phone just got disconnected. Judith, should I keep talking? Okay, I guess I will keep talking. There probably won't be airline kiosks in 10 years. It's really an outrage. And IBM has had very accessible airline kiosks for many years. So the National Federation of the Blind has a pending lawsuit against the Department of Transportation for having such a long time to make those kiosks accessible. Okay, I'm going to real quick, just say there's still issues, digital issues with shopping. eBay has a new agreement to make sure that their seller tools and websites are accessible. Redbox Movie Kiosk had a lawsuit. I did a negotiations with Raley's to make sure their point of sale devices were accessible. Okay, this slide called Wrinkles is illustrated by a crumbling brick wall. And that's because thus far, we've been talking about all the positive advances in the law and what advocates in the legal space are doing to bring about digital accessibility. We had, I don't even want to call it a setback, we had a slight wrinkle out here in California with two cases decided within the last couple months that held that the ADA did not apply to websites unless there was a connection to a brick and mortar building. So that's why this slide is illustrated by bricks, but it's also illustrated by a crumbling brick wall to illustrate my feeling that this argument is crumbling. And even though there are these two cases, one is called Cullen versus Netflix, and one is called Earl versus eBay, they were very short decisions. They're what they call unpublished, which means I don't actually know what it means, but you can't use it to argue a different case. And ironically, these cases are against Netflix and eBay, which are two companies we've already talked about this morning, have already committed Netflix to their captioning, eBay to their website. So I feel like these are cases that have been pending for a long time. They only apply in the Ninth Circuit, which is the West Coast part of the federal court system. Websites are all over the country. So while a court in California might have said the ADA does not apply to your website, in Massachusetts and Vermont, so far the courts have said, yes, websites are covered even if there is no brick and mortar. So I call this a little wrinkle.
Lainey, I'm sorry to interrupt. We just need to make sure that the phone bridge is still working. Claudia, okay. Can you comment?
Sorry, Lainey, it looks like we might have a problem with our phone bridge again. So please just stand by for a second. I believe that is being looked at right now.
Okay, I think we're good.
Okay,
all right,
thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay, so yeah, that's... So, you know, I would be remiss in not letting you know about these wrinkles, but they're there, but the law is absolutely without question going in the direction of history, which is digital is here to stay, and inclusion and fairness, and the Swooping ADA is here to stay. So just one really quick thing, if my slide will advance, and if not, I will tell it to you without my slide, which is all of these cases in the legal space start with a phone call. Where a person with a disability
will not connect you to your call. Line muted.
Hello?
Sorry, Lenny, carry on.
Carry on. Okay. Okay, good. Now my slide's going too. So all these cases start with either a phone call where a disabled person can't do something, they call up. Half the time they hear the following, can't you get someone to help you with that? And the reason I call this slide start and end, because people do not want to file lawsuits or even do the kinder, gentler law that I do, structured negotiations, to have access to their school classwork or to register for classes or to shop online or to vote or do any of these things. They just want to be able to do it. And when they call, if they got a response that was responsive, then probably these legal actions would not be here. And I'm a big believer in thinking that lawyers should really be out of this space, that accessibility and usability should be a very exciting thing that developers and designers and site owners and colleges all want to do. And, you know, the law has had to get involved because people don't get the right answers. People fill in a feedback form. The feedback form is not accessible. They can't even submit a problem. So for those of you listening who have any, you know, control or ability to get institutions to do anything, I would say get people on the phone who understand that people with disabilities use digital technology. And many of these lawsuits, many of this legal work would not have to be done. It would be being done without lawyers. So that's really the lay of the land, the legal landscape. Does anybody have any questions?
Hi, Lenny. Sorry, we're still having a little bit of a problem with our phone bridge. At this stage, it does not look like we have too many questions, but one of the questions that I had, or one of the comments that I had specifically about the emergency preparation, is that it is something that the ADA National Network is very involved with. It's something that we do a webinar series right on that directly. So I would encourage people who are interested in finding out more about the emergency preparation preparedness to look at your local ADA National Network site, and that would be, for example, here in California is the ADAPacific.org website or the Great Lakes website, and that would give you some indications of some of the work that we are doing. But other than that, let me check to see if there are any other questions. It doesn't look like it right now. So I think we're probably pretty good.
Okay, well then let me just go over what I'm showing on the slide now in case for people who can't see it. So my website is lflegal.com, lflegal.com. There's a lot of content on there. Two quick ways in. There's a high-level link that says structured negotiations or lflegal.com/negotiations. And you can learn about structured negotiations. You can read all of the agreements that we've negotiated. The other good way in is through the categories page. In all of these cases that I've worked on, we've done positive press releases with the companies, and you can read all the press releases, and you can look at the various topics. Some of the things we haven't addressed today is we've worked on accessible pedestrian signals, like I said, mobile devices, websites, talking pill bottles, movie audio description, Braille and large print information. So you can see all that through the categories page. And again, for those of you on Twitter, I'm at LF Legal. And there's a contact page on the website, but also, again, give you my email. If anyone wants to be in touch, I'm happy to be in touch. It's lf@lflegal.com.
Great. All right. That's wonderful. It doesn't look like we do have any more questions at this stage, except just one comment specifically for you, lady, from somebody who said, I just want to thank you very much for this in capitals awesome training. So thank you so much. It really was a very awesome training. So I think with that, it really is just the finalize it all, a great topic. You've given us an enormous amount to think about and to talk about right here. Certainly kept me up to date now with some of the legal stuff that's out there and how we can proceed from there. So again, thank you so much. We look forward to continuing our relationship with you, and hopefully we can get you in when we finally get that that Section 508 update or the other NPRMs that are outstanding to come through. But in the meantime, for those of you who are regular attendees of this session, just a reminder that our next session will be on July 16th, and that one we will be returning more to a very technical presentation where we're going to be looking at turning text into speech, and we're going to be looking at real world applications and examples and some of the nice apps and tools that are out there. So we would encourage you and invite you to join us again for that. And once again, we do apologize for some of the disruptions that we had with the phone bridge disconnecting. It is a frustration, and I apologize both to our listeners and to Lainey. Thank you for accommodating us with that. So once again, thank you all very much, and we look forward to seeing you all again and being with you again on the 16th of July.